So my little girl has been having a heart attack since yesterday. I've had my ideas coming together for quite a while, and last night when I sat down to really start, okay, let's get serious and put it all together, it just wasn't coming as easily as I thought it would. And so being the type that's a little bit of a perfectionist and really likes to feel comfortable, that was very uncomfortable. So I have with me a little favorite friend of mine to help me tonight, because sometimes little girls need some support. So my little stuffed animal's here with me. And then I also asked my husband, he couldn't be with me tonight because we had a family commitment come up tonight that couldn't be any other night. And so he sent me with a prayer, and I really appreciate his prayer because it's just so perfect. And so his prayer for me is, God, help me set aside everything I know about recovery just for this next 30, 40 minutes so that I have an open mind and can receive guidance from you. Mm-hmm. So with that, I will get started. I'm really grateful to see all of you here, and I'm really grateful the people that showed up tonight. It's just amazing to me. There's a lot of recovery in here. There's a lot of newness. I came to the intergroup meeting, and it was fun to hear the liveliness at the intergroup meeting. I've been gone for a while, so I'm feeling really grateful. So where do I start? I'm going to look at my watch to make sure I'm kind of timing myself here. So,
all the time you need, Kim.
Thank you. So the first thing I want to do, I looked in the Red Book last night in my journey of trying to figure out what I needed to do, and it says how important it is to share equally a little bit about what happened in our past, what brought us into recovery, and then what it's like now that we're in recovery. So I'd like to start with, you know, what qualifies me for this program. I'm an only child, and my dad was an alcoholic, and my mom was definitely a codependent. And when I came into this program, as we know, we start doing the first step and how unmanageable our life is. And I think it's in the first step that it has us do our family history, or we do drawing if we want. And when I started doing that drawing and I was reading all the different labels of things that might have impacted us growing up, it was astounding. It was just astounding to me, the mental health issues, the addiction issues. Addiction meaning it could have been alcohol, it could have been drugs, could have been prescription drugs, could have been mental health, the workaholism, sexaholism, food addictions, what else? Those are, you know, a lot of them right there. And as I looked through my family, you know, we had it all over the place. So I found that really helpful because I wasn't understanding until I got to ACA what was wrong with me. I was the kind of kid that said I had the perfect childhood, right? You know, I don't know what everybody's problem is, but mine was fine. I had everything I needed. So I didn't really understand why I was sitting in 12-step rooms identifying with what everybody was saying. I came into the 12-step rooms, it'll be 23 years next Friday. I came into Codependence Anonymous, and we were doing ACA work also at that time. And I came in and sat there, and I listened to people tell stories about their childhoods that sounded extremely painful. And yet I was sitting there with them and just as miserable as they were, and I was doing all the same things they were, and I had food addiction issues, you know, that I had to work through. So I just didn't understand what it was all about, but doing that diagram helped me a lot. And now all these years of working the workbook and going through the Red Book is amazing. But as I'm doing that, I'm slowly pulling the little pieces of yarn out of that mess of yarn. And what I'm learning is how subtle and sneaky this disease can be. You know, that somebody can have no alcohol in their family of origin and yet still be in the room right beside me. And it's just because it's so sneaky. It's the way that we abandon each other in these little ways that are actually pretty significant. So I just want to share a few things about growing up in my family. My parents were really young when they had me. They were both around 20 years old. And they were going to school. They were working full time. They had me. And so there wasn't a lot of time really to have a child. No, by the way, now I know after all these years, you know, our brains are still developing until we're like 26 years old. And so they, you know, they hadn't even gotten there yet. And my dad, he was the alcoholic. He was handsome, dashing. My mom absolutely adored him. And they were just a really great match with each other. And I think I now understand that they wanted to have me, but growing up, I never felt like they really wanted to have me because it didn't seem like my childhood was much about me. It was about them. And it kind of makes sense, you know, now that I've been an adult for a while and raised my own kids. I just feel like they were doing the best they could with what they had. And my mom, you know, as I look back in time, actually came from a family with mental health issues. Her mom had severe mental health issues, and so she was abused as a little girl. So she learned to be very rigid and very particular and perfectionistic because that was how she could avoid getting hurt in her family growing up. She worked really hard. She was very creative. And she wanted to do it better when she had a little girl. So some of the ways that she tried to do it better with me, as an example, is she didn't want to put my hair into braids or pigtails much. And I couldn't, seems like kind of a funny thing, but actually it's because her mom would force her to have her hair braided. She had beautiful long blonde hair, and her mom, being so upset and, you know, dealing with whatever she had, would pull my mom's hair like crazy and slam her with the brush and do things. And so my mom didn't want to do that to me. You know, so my experience of my mom growing up was definitely not nurturing. She was very particular, I would say rigid, not nurturing at all. very smart. She was a counselor. So she would listen to me, but she would often I would feel like I hadn't done it right. I never knew as much as she did, obviously, because she's 20 years older than me. And it never seemed like I had the right answer, and I just felt totally inadequate with my mom. I had the kind of childhood where, you know, my mom wanted me to do the chores. That's expected at a very young age. And I just remember at 5 having this meltdown because I could not get it right. Like, I couldn't do anything right for my mom. It was never right. And, you know, go clean the bathroom. And I did the best I could. And she comes in, and, I mean, she might as well have had white gloves on, you know, running around with little white gloves. But that was so painful as a little girl. It was very serious. Life felt very serious as a little girl. And one of the things that manifested with my mom and dad and I were very enmeshed, you know, very small little family. And they moved away from where they grew up because they wanted to do it better. You know, they needed to get away from all the family chaos of their families. So they moved us across from Wisconsin to Oregon. And they started their new life in Oregon when I was 3. And they found friends that usually drank and played cards and whatever because nobody ever had money. And none of them ever had kids. So that was part of what led me to believe my parents didn't really like kids, was because they never had friends with kids, it seemed like. And yet, my dad was a teacher, my mom was a teacher, my mom was a high school counselor. So they lived with kids all day long. And I would hear them tell stories, you know, while drinking or whatever, about all, you know, the things that drove them crazy. And so what I learned from my parents growing up was kids are no fun. Kids change your life completely. So they're trying to get me to not get pregnant, I'm sure. But they will change your life completely. It will not be the same once you have kids. Don't think that that will do anything for you. So it's like just not feeling really wanted was kind of the message that I got. Let's see. A lot of the activities that we did growing up were around what my parents wanted to do. And so we would spend our money not on trips per se, unless it was to go visit family, because they definitely felt it was important to visit family back in Wisconsin. But what we'd also spend our money on would be fixing up the house and fixing up the yard. And that's what they did. They were teachers. They had summers off. So they'd work all vacations, workaholism maybe. And we would do that. And so on one hand, I got exposed to all these really amazing experiences. You know, I learned how to play in my dad's wood shop and, you know, learned how to do concrete work and waterfalls and, They took me hunting because that's what we did. We'd go deer hunting and, you know, we cut firewood and fished and did all the things that we would do in Oregon, which were better. My parents thought was definitely better than what they had growing up, because for them growing up, their parents weren't there maybe at all. So they definitely were trying to do it better with me by doing everything with me. But I did everything with them. Let's say that. I did everything with them. What they wanted to do, I did everything with them. I went to the pizza parlor while they drank beer every Friday night as a little girl, and I entertained myself. Whatever you do in a pizza parlor with them drinking beer, you know. I'd go to their friends' houses where they would drink, and we'd have dinner, and they'd play cards all night, and I had to go try to sleep in the back bedroom while they're all hooting and hollering and doing their thing. And sometimes, you know, as happens when there's drinking, I'd come out, well, I'd get woken up because it's time to go home, except everybody was in chaos. You know, there's whatever had happened, I guess instead of beer, they got into the whiskey that night or whatever. And sometimes my dad would be gone. Where's he at? Well, he and so-and-so went down to go play cards or whatever. You know, my mom's all upset. We're driving home without my dad. Where's my dad, you know? Or we were driving home and my dad's totally hammered, you know, passed out in the passenger seat and being all schmoozy with my mom, which she hated. And as a little girl in the back seat, felt gross for me. So kind of the classic ACA family in a lot of ways now, I know. My parents also wanted me to be really independent, because that was another thing they valued, was being independent, you know, self-sufficient, if you will. And so I've got these interesting things I got to do as a little girl, but I'm not sure in hindsight that it was really good ideas. So, for example, my parents moved from Wisconsin to Oregon, and when I was 5, it was like we moved when I was 3. So a year and a half later, the grandparents were missing me. And my parents had bought their first really fixer-upper home, because that's what they could afford. And so my grandfather paid a plane ticket for me to fly to Wisconsin. So a little girl, 5, goes by herself for the first time ever on an airplane and flies to Wisconsin for 5 weeks. Makes perfect sense, right? I've never been away from my parents before. And I was supposed to be okay with that. And it was great. It was really good for me. But, you know, when I think about some of the things I have as an adult child now, I was scared from such a young age growing up. Scared because of the chaos when my parents were drinking at night when I'm supposed to be sleeping like a good little girl. You know, scared of what I'd wake up to. Scared of having to be brave. I had to be brave to get on that airplane and go by myself away from my parents and everything I knew for 5 weeks to grandparents that I don't really remember as well. You know what I'm saying? It's like I had to be brave. And that was valued in my family, to be brave. And when I wasn't brave, I would get picked on. My parents, my dad especially, he was the more nurturing of the two parents. And he'd play games with me and he liked to sit with me and draw and do things. But he also was very uncomfortable with feelings. And so if I would get sad or scared or whatever, his way to handle it would be to, like, tickle me. And, you know, the classic tickling, you tickle somebody too much to death almost, where they pee their pants or they're laughing so hard it hurts that they're now crying. He would do that. Or he'd just tease me. He and my mom would start tag-teaming on the, oh, look at the poor little girl, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And it was just so frustrating. So anyway, a lot of the classic ACA stuff growing up. By the time I was an adolescent, you know, the key years, you start becoming a little more independent, my parents would have none of it. None of it. My dad was the bad kid growing up. My mom was the cop's daughter growing up. They dated, and he got her into trouble all the time. And so they knew what kids do to get in trouble. Plus, they're in my high school, where I go to school, as teachers. And then keep an eye on me. And so as I went through my high school years, in hindsight now, I think I was depressed. Because what's the point? Like, life felt pretty hopeless a lot of the time. But also, I became very defiant. You know, it's like defiance being that angry, 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 like simmering, seething anger. And so I had depression and anger simmering like that. And that's when my eating issues took off. So I started down the path of anorexia because food was the one thing I had control over in my environment. And then my parents got me there too. The victim part, you see, still lives on. Because, you know, my mom's a counselor. And they finally realized I was losing weight and had an eating problem. And so they had me watch a special on TV, because that's what we had back then, was just TV. No, didn't even have VHS hardly, it seemed like. And they had me watch this special, and then I said, this food stuff, I might be doing that. And so they told me in no uncertain terms that they would not have any of that. And from now on, they were going to monitor what I ate, and I would always eat at meals from now on. And if I didn't, they'd make me eat or whatever, you know, I would be punished. And it's like, coming into this ACA world where we learn how to better take care of ourselves, like, that was the worst thing in the world for somebody that has an eating issue. You know, eating issues, you know, not counseling, but instead we're just going to control you. And so that, my defiance then, it went like another level, you know, further. And so, and this is all getting, I'm almost up to where I hit recovery here. So I left home. I'm a people pleaser. I honestly wanted my parents to love me and accept me. Like, I really wanted them to accept me. And I've always thought my parents actually were amazing. They were just so smart and creative and did interesting things all my life. And I always felt like I couldn't keep up with them as a little girl, because I was 20 years younger, right? but I always admired them. And I so wanted to have them just be really proud of me. And so my mom, as a high school counselor, went and visited Annapolis, the Naval Academy, and came home just oohing and aahing about these cadets. Oh, these cadets, they were just the most amazing things, these midshipmen. And so I decided I was going to go do something like that. And so I ended up going to the Air Force Academy, and I was in basic training for, like, I don't even know if it was a full week before I realized that was the last place on earth that was a good fit for me. It was horrifying. It was absolutely horrifying to me. I had studied it all. I had planned for it all. I was in shape as much as I could be. I was ready for it. But as somebody who had been sexually abused a little bit as a girl, and then had been an ACA or growing up, you know, where I'm afraid of authority figures, I have lots of issues with men. Had a lot of issues with men. My dad really would have wished I had been a boy. So that was how I spent a lot of my life, was trying to be a good tomboy. And I was excellent at it. I could win at arm wrestling with the guys sometimes. I mean, I shoveled concrete. I hauled rocks. I chopped the wood. I did all that. And I went to the Air Force Academy to basic training, and I about had a heart attack. My brain, I couldn't remember anything. We had to memorize stuff. I could not see the point of why we were caring how big our T-shirts were folded up. And so I decided I wanted to leave. And I was only 17 years old. And so my parents would not sign the paperwork for me to leave. And so for me, that was like strike three of defiance, going to the deepest of deep levels. I just felt so abandoned. And that's the thing I've learned in ACA, is that abandonment. So it's shame and blame. But it's that abandonment stuff that really, really locked in for me. So my eating issues just went crazy. I dated a guy in my freshman squadron that my parents totally would not have appreciated. I started acting out. And this is now where it all became part of my internal dialogue. If it wasn't already, it definitely was now. I ended up, my parents were like, if you just stay however long, we'll let you come home at, you know, this point in the year. We'll let you come home then. And that's where the defiant kicked in. It's like, I'll decide when I'm coming home now. Because I didn't want to go home and be with them anymore. So I ended up staying at the Air Force Academy, and I'm grateful I did. It's part of the journey. It wasn't me at all in a lot of ways. And so I did that, and I met my first husband there, and then I went into the military. And right away, just like my parents did, I had my two kids right away. So I still wasn't 26 and had both kids in a marriage, and that's about the time that then I found recovery. We had gone all over the place, you know, school in Colorado, went to South Dakota, went to Alabama. I thought I could live anywhere, and being from the West Coast, And then being in Alabama as a woman at the time I was there was like, oh my gosh, between all the racial segregation issues and women issues and whatever, I'm like, wow, boy, not my tribe. And so we got stationed out here at Vandenberg, and I was so excited to get back on the West Coast. And that was when I read, I don't know if you've heard of the book Codependent No More, but that's when I realized I was codependent. And that was my way in to the 12 steps. And so 23 years ago, I went to my first CODA 12-step meeting, and it was actually a master's class assignment. I didn't just go because of me. It was an assignment. We had to go to a 12-step meeting and report back, and I, of course, chose CODA because that was the closest thing to what I just read about. And I'm so grateful. So that's kind of what it was like before. So then I come into recovery, and my marriage did not last much longer. So I'm a single mom now in recovery with young kids. And I'm so grateful how my higher power works, because I got a higher power back. By coming into 12 steps, I got my higher power back. I never could fit in. I couldn't seem to fit in. I tried so many different churches, so many different things. And every time there were things I couldn't fit in that box, and I felt like, well, great, everybody else gets to have whatever God is to them. I don't even know anymore. So coming back into recovery, that's one of the first things I got back was my higher power, and I was so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful I had my kids, because as soon as I came into the rooms, I realized how sick I am. And that, oh my gosh, the thing I heard was, this is generational. Like, you know what? You can come to recovery and you can start your process, but it might take up to 5 generations to bleed out of our family line. And I was horrified when I heard that, because I knew how miserable I was coming into recovery. I mean, I hated myself. I absolutely hated myself. I just hated so much about me and what I chose to do. And that took a lot of work to try to recover from. So I've got down here on my notes, you know, what are some of the things? Coming into recovery, I right away heard, you know, well, you know, start the steps, get a sponsor. And so that's what I did, is I went and got a sponsor right away and started working in the steps. And it was so great, because I love when people cross-pollinate between all the different 12-step meetings, because there's so much richness there. And so the people that I was working with kept, you know, I was working in the Codependence Anonymous steps at this point, and they kept saying, you got to figure out your family of origin issues. I'm like, my what? You know? I knew I had a problem in my marriage and with relationships and boundaries, but what are you talking about? Because I had a fine childhood. My childhood is fine. No, you got to do that. And so they're the ones that helped me start into the ACA process. And that was in 1997. I worked through the steps. Then a couple of years, I stayed in recovery because of my kids. It was like, I've got to figure this out so I bring something better to my family. My mom was a control freak. There were so many rules. I mean, I was the senior in high school that we had an open campus. My friends all had cars. I didn't get to have a car. But not only that, I couldn't even go with them at lunch, down to eat lunch, wherever they were going. You know, I had to stay on the school campus to eat lunch. So anyway, she was very strict, wanting to probably keep me safe, right? Keep me doing well in school. So good intentions, and I just didn't know what to do with my own kids then. Like, I knew what my mom and dad did wasn't quite right, but I didn't know how to do it differently. And so honestly, recovery is where I learned how to raise my kids, and I learned how to do things differently. And I'm like, well, what boundaries do you have with kids? And they told me, the first thing I heard is, well, I mean, really, it's about keeping them safe, you know? So as long as they're not going to, you know, have safety threatened, they can probably do almost anything. And I'm like, whoa, that's a lot more free than how I grew up. I had so many rules. So let's see, I worked through those 12 steps, and so another thing I learned in recovery, along with having a sponsor, working your steps, going to the meetings, calling people, is I learned that you start the steps over again, you just keep starting them over and over and over again. And so that's what I've done over all these years. We did different 12-step workbooks to kind of get that variety in. And I don't know what year it was exactly, but I'm thinking I know I discovered my inner child in 2004 because a friend and I were doing weekend retreats where we'd bring people in and we'd all do things together, try to get to healing. And we had a visualization and I met my inner child. And it was really powerful because when I met my inner child in my mind's eye, my kids were old enough at this point. They were like 4 and 7. And my inner child in my mind at that point, she was about 4 years old. So, you know, kind of in that same age range. And she would have nothing to do with me in this image, you know, this visualization. I couldn't convince her to even look at me. Like her back was to me. She was looking out over an edge. And she wouldn't talk to me. And with my kids, my real kids, I mean, you know, they'd get hurt. But usually you could kind of like, if you'd sit down beside them and kind of be there and give them a little space and then kind of pick at them a little or hug them, or, you know, eventually they'd kind of like, you know, they'd tell you whatever was really going on. And she didn't do that and wouldn't. And that was pretty significant. So it was around then that we were starting another round of doing the 12 steps. And I had found that yellow ACA workbook. And so we had a circle of us that did the ACA workbook, and that's when I started realizing how big of a problem it was, my inner critical parent that I carried with me, that was my mom or my dad or whatever it was at this point. So that's really when my ACA recovery started. So now I just wanted to bring up, in our red book, they talk about different levels of, you know, like how long have you been in recovery? I got to put my glasses on so I can see this. But it talks on page 580 about how long have we been in recovery. And it says, like, maybe it's on page 580. And it says for, like, the first year or a few years that we're busy cleaning up the wreckage of our past. And I definitely feel like I did that in my first 12-step program. I mean, I really worked on my inventory and I made my amends and I felt the relief that comes with that. You know, it's like, oh, thank goodness. Now we're just dealing with things as they come up more versus all the mess. And then it says, well, you've been now doing recovery for a little while. And so now we're putting our life in order, and that's what our sharing is starting to look like. And it says, we struggle less with fear and self-doubt. We recognize our denial sooner. We are helping out with the group and sponsoring others. And we have a greater understanding of grief and loss. So I feel like when I started the ACA 12 steps, that's where I was at. I was in that phase, if you will, where it's like, yeah, I get this. Yeah, this is a lot of work. Yeah, I see how it's important. But I hadn't yet gotten how deep my ACA stuff is. And now I can say I don't think I will ever know how deep it goes because it surprises me all the time. And so that's where it talks about, you know, we might stray away from the meetings. And I had a period where I left the CODA meetings, but I was doing the 12-step yellow ACA book, but I hadn't gotten to ACA meetings yet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's like I was working the program, but I wasn't yet coming to the meetings. And so for me, again, I feel like that was that period where I'm like, yeah, okay, I got it. I'm working it. I got it. But it wasn't 100%. So then, I don't know what year it was that we actually started having meetings in Santa Maria. It hasn't, you know, like 5, 6, 7 years ago maybe at the most was when we started actually having open ACA meetings. They weren't closed to this little workbook group or whatever. And that's now where I feel like the real game has come. You know, it's like I go to the meetings and people are sharing things there. I'm witnessing them taking risks and doing things differently. We talk about, you know, being gentle with ourselves, you know, being honest, open-minded, and willing. And so over these last years, I've had a lot of things that my higher power thought I needed to do to kind of like get my program in a different way. I guess today what I see with my higher power is my higher power gives me whatever I need to make the changes I need to make. And I feel like I must not listen very well sometimes because it feels like it gets really intense sometimes, and I know that that's how I change. So for my last 10 years that I've been married. This is the second marriage. I looked and I chose my husband very carefully with recovery. I had learned a lot about who I was and very much chose him. And then my higher power knew that once I married a second time, I was not going to like fail again, right? Because I'm an easy hater. And things got really hard. And they've been really hard for a lot of these years for various reasons. And it has to do with just, we lost our ability to communicate as well as when we were dating. And we just had health issues, mental health and other health issues all surrounding us. And it was so frustrating to feel it all slip through my fingers again. Because I've already done this recovery thing. I don't get it. Why can't I do this, right? It's all about me. Why can't I do this? So my higher power was working me, and I have really been persistent with the steps thanks to that. And I've had to just turn it over. And this program, I struggle at work. I struggle in my relationships. I struggle with my health. Those are the three things. They're pretty much all about life. And thanks to recovery, I've been able to do it differently, a little at a time. And so, I go to the meetings and I listen and we read this book. I love that the meetings that I go to, and we're literally reading through this book and talking about it, or reading in the Daily Reader, and then having sponsees talking about things, whatever's going on in their lives, is helping me realize I can do my life too, so I'm not alone. In ACA and with these things that have been going on, everybody makes mistakes. We are so human, I'm finding, especially me, but all of us. And, part of my journey back, with my husband has been learning that he is not going to be the way I wish he were. It's like I had an idea. Maybe that's my ACA-ism. I had this idea, and he's doing the best he can, and it's still not going to be that way. So that left me to have to decide what I'm going to do about that. And in my program, I have prayed and let go and worked my steps. And I've prayed and I've let go and I've worked my steps. And over this last year, my physical health was failing because work is full of my family of origin too. And it was too much stress, honestly. It was too much stress. And so I feel like the program is what kept me moving along, trying to learn what I could. And I was praying to be able to accept my husband and accept things as they were. And I don't know if you've heard, awareness is where it starts, and then acceptance, and then action. For me, acceptance is the whole grief process. I mean, for me to accept, I have to do so much grieving. So in my marriage and with work issues too, it's okay, I have this awareness now of something that's really hard for me, or I can't seem to do this. So what am I going to do about that? I can't accept it. That wasn't okay with me that this is the way it was. So there's a lot of grieving that's gone on, and I so appreciate the fellow travelers that have helped me get through that grieving process and keep letting go. And so with my marriage, it's been really hard for a long time. And thankfully with recovery, sometimes there's these annual events. You go to an annual convention or an annual weekend thing. So the first year I went, I was a mess because I was so sad about my marriage and my relationship and how I couldn't figure it out. And then I went back a year later, and something had just happened in the marriage again that I was really a mess again. Tears all over the place. I just want to be a part of things, but I'm just a mess. So I'm like, ooh. And so I told myself I wasn't going to come back a third time in that same state. And so that held me accountable, and that's part of what the 12 steps does for me, and being like why I come to the meetings and I get to know people and we have relationships, is there's that extra support, encouragement, and it's accountability too. And so I didn't want to come back a third time and have myself be such a mess. And so I actually had to start doing what I didn't want to do, which was letting go of my marriage. It's just taking steps to take care of myself. And as an ACA-er, it's so hard to take care of myself over others. You know, that fear of abandonment, the people pleasing, just not wanting to fail. So anyway, all that to say, as I started letting go of my marriage because I could not get my higher power to change me so it could all be okay, I kept praying, please change me so I can be okay with the way things are. And I wasn't getting that. So, okay, then I guess I have to start shifting. And it was very slowly, because the program teaches me, too, that you just slowly, man, you don't do things fast. I used to do them fast, and, it'd blow up. So now, you know, I pause, I breathe, I pray, I talk to people. So anyway, one little thing at a time, I was slowly meandering myself in my marriage. And every time I'd get to that next point, my husband would shift and meet me there. And, you know, it's like the first time, it's I don't know how to describe it other than it's exasperating, and I was so grateful. Like, it took so much courage for me doing my steps to get to that point where I'd finally be like, okay, I can't do this anymore. I think we got to do something, you know, I think we got to let go or whatever. And then he'd meet me there, and I was like, well, huh, all right. And so that's what our last year has been like, is constantly like, it's so frustrating. Where I'm at is, well, I've learned a lot, because now I'm learning, well, what, I wonder what would have happened if I hadn't spent so long praying to accept my husband the way he is and had instead sooner. It took what it took, right? It takes what it takes. And my higher power, for me, my higher power does things only just in time, and like sometimes it's so close to being late that it's like, I don't know if it's just in time. That is so how it works. And so where I'm at today is I have so much respect for these programs and how deep these diseases are. I don't know how to do things. I don't know how to do things differently. It happens when it happens. It's on my higher power's time. My husband and I were asked to share this summer, in I think it was like August or July, we were asked in programs that we share together to speak together. And that was kind of horrifying, because what I've learned in recovery is when you're asked to do something, you usually say yes, you know, because it's part of being a service, it's part of the way it works with our higher power or whatever. And so we were asked to share, to co-share about ourselves with our sister programs, and I had no confidence at that point I was going to be able to pull off this marriage. Our 10th anniversary was last month, 1 month ago from now. And so we had to think about that and pray about that, because, like, well, what if we share and then we don't make it? And so we did our talk together October 26th. That was 1 month, literally, before our 10-year anniversary, and we still didn't know what the answer was yet. We still hadn't gotten there yet. And I share that only because of the way my higher power works, the way the program works, is my higher power had something going on. It was part of a process, and I kept praying, please get me off the fence, because I'm the one that was like, I can't do this. Either get me in or get me out, but I'm not doing on the fence anymore. I'm done with it. And when we shared at that meeting together, my husband was able to share things that he hadn't been able to share with me yet, because he's probably an ACA or two, and he didn't feel safe with me yet. And somehow he was able to share in front of a whole room of people. And then I got to share, and that was our door. That was the door that finally opened. And so we had one more month before our 10-year anniversary. And ACA teaches me to show up, have courage, trust my higher power, do the best I can. It's okay to make mistakes. And so during our last month, we actually took a lot of the things out of the ACA program and developed kind of, my husband didn't like the word agreement, so we have operating principles. And I was just laughing, because in ACA, we're allowed to disagree today, right? It's okay to be different. And today I can just wait and see how things unfold better than I ever used to. And then, of course, you know, we have the traditions that tell us how to do our meetings, and they actually apply really nicely to our relationships, too. And I'm like, well, I feel like we kind of need a purpose together. Like, why should we stay together in our marriage? And so we kind of went back and forth with that. And again, I'm just so grateful because in ACA, I'm learning to just, it just unfolds today. And so we actually recommitted on the 26th of November, and it wasn't all flowers and sun, but that's our new chapter. The new chapter is one where we get to be who we are. He gets to be the way he is, but I get to be the way I am too. And that means it's got to be okay, and it's not going to be beautiful and sun and flowers all the time. So it was actually kind of ironic because that was what that day was like. It was just one of those days, and yet we were able to do it okay. And since then, there's so much more acceptance. And so I'm tonight just going to end with how much I think this program works. And it feels like the peeling of the onions. There's always another layer. They used to say that. You know, it's like, oh, there's the peeling of the onion layers. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And then they'd say, you know, just keep coming back. It works if you work. Yeah, whatever. Okay, you know. And so in the ACA book, I was noticing that it talks about old timers. And I was laughing because I think I might almost qualify now as an old timer. By the things it says we remain active in ACA meetings and we understand that giving service is love for ourselves and others. I can't tell you how much sponsoring people is amazing for me. We sponsor others and greet newcomers at meetings. We take care of ourselves as well. Although we have time in the program, we ask for help. I have had to ask for so much help to be able to just survive and actually try to thrive in this journey. Let's see, although we have time in the program, we ask for help. We share in meetings about working the steps, sponsoring others, and reparenting ourselves with self-love. We also share about still learning to say no. We learn to say, I don't know. Absolutely, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know. I don't have to know anymore. I don't know. We support the 12 steps and 12 traditions. At a group business meeting, we state our opinion. So we show up, right, invest ourselves, participate. I do that in my marriage better than I ever have today. I know there's still more to learn. but do that at our meetings. We state our opinion and support the group decision whether we agree or not. And again, I'm able to take all the things we learn here and apply it at work and in my relationship. We share about life on life's terms. We share our successes and we let others celebrate with us. We talk about our feelings and insecurities as well. We talk about our spiritual awakening and the true connection to God through the inner child. We have come to believe we know how to have fun. And I just want to say, you know, in closing that today, that little girl inside of me, She turned around years ago, but I had to show her I could be a safe, protective, loving parent, that I would not criticize her. I would not abandon her. My defiance would not take her out, you know, and I had to work at that for a long time. And today I delight in her. You know, that is why I have this little guy up here with me. It's like she gets to show up today and I delight in her. She shows up at work in the goofiest ways sometimes, and I work with a bunch of, you know, pretty serious people. And today that just makes me feel so happy. And today, you know, like for example, with my husband, when my little girl is feeling insecure or whatever, I can so imagine holding her, patting her, you know, loving her. And so today when my little girl was definitely like, okay, I don't know what we're going to talk about, and that's not very comfortable, I actually, you know, took an Epsom salt bath and I went for a walk and, you know, still showed up to do my responsibilities today. I went and visited family with my husband before coming here. But it's just that desire to really make sure she feels safe and as supported as she can today. And it's reassuring her, you know what, higher power's got it. We just got to show up, and whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and it's going to be perfect. So the last thing is I have this little thing. So my husband, he's really cute. He doesn't know what to get me for gifts, and it really stresses him out. And so he gave me a little Visa gift card, actually. He gave me a Visa gift card, but it was inside of, I unwrapped the box. And the box says, here is your kit for making your earwax candle. And it shows this candle lit, and then it shows this little head contraption that somehow, you know, you get the earwax out and into this candle. And I'm just kind of looking at him like, I don't know that I want this, right? And so I'm kind of like, you know, open it up, and thankfully inside, you know, he's got 2x4s, and in between the 2x4s is this little Visa gift card. And so I could appreciate his humor, you know. But we went to Starbucks today, and so I have my little Visa gift card, and we went in. My little girl just delighted in this. It says the Been There series. Been There series, you know. I appreciate that. I've been there, it feels like. And then it's just this cute little cup. My little girl thinks this little cup is darling. It's California. And if anybody's from Oregon, you would know that Oregonians hate Californians. They hate them. My dad couldn't stand it that I'm a Californian. Anyway, it's got all my favorite places and things, you know, the waves for surfing and just all the things I love about California. And my little girl just was so delighted in that today. And I appreciate that because that's, you know, it's like my husband gave me that gift card and I got to get exactly what I wanted. And it's all good today versus years ago, long ago in recovery, I wouldn't have appreciated that the same way. I would have thought he was ridiculous with his box, you know, and then give me a gift card, really? Like, he couldn't go out and get me, you know? And today, it's all good, and I really appreciate that. So, thank you for listening to my story tonight. I really appreciate it.